Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the climate wars, the scenarios we are facing, and our options as a humanity. Then, on the Scholar Circle, political power is changing. We'll explore what power is, who has power, and how new developments are changing all of that. Our options as a humanity may be dwindling in the face of climate change, says our next guest. The coming changes may completely alter the world as we know it, with collapsed ecosystems, mass immigration of climate refugees, and more devastating wars over basic necessities such as food and water. Gwen Dyer is a journalist, columnist, author, broadcaster, and lecturer on international affairs for more than 20 years. He's the author of numerous books, including War Future, Tents, and the Mess They Made, as well as his most recent book, Climate Wars, The Fight for Survival as the World Overheats. First of all, well, let's start with what you say may be actually better off. You're saying Scandinavia is a little better off in some ways. Russia might be, Canada might be, Britain might be. They're the winners potentially, but the losers are the South, China. Why?
Well, the closer you are to the equator, the more trouble you're in a warming world. Essentially, the trouble is food. The major impact of warming on human populations is going to be that it cuts into the food supply quite seriously. But that doesn't happen equally all over the planet. The further away you are from the equator, until you get right up in the high north where they don't grow food anyway, but the further away you are from the equator, the less pronounced the warming and the less the impact on food production. So even most of the United States can expect to go on producing food in much the way it does now, though not the southern bits, because the southern bits of the U.S. are actually in the subtropics. People don't realize that, but that's what they are. And the subtropics get hit very hard by this. Essentially, they dry out. They're already very dry, but they suffer a great loss of rainfall. And, you know, basically, without rain, you can't grow crops. So we're looking at places like southwestern U.S., Mexico, Central America, both sides of the Mediterranean, the north side, you know, Spain and Italy and so on, as well as the south, right across the Middle East, Turkey, Iran, places like that. Same story in the southern hemisphere. Most of Australia is in the subtropics, except the very southern fringe of it. Southern Africa, these are places that dry out and can no longer produce a lot of food, which, of course, is kind of non-negotiable. You either eat or die. And so your first impact is on populations that simply can't feed themselves anymore. The further away you are from the equator, the less you are hit by that sort of thing. If you live, say north of the Great Lakes in North America, or even on the south side of the Great Lakes, you're far enough away that you're probably okay until we hit, 2 or 3 degrees of higher average global temperature, which is a good 20 or 30 years away. So it's very much positional. It depends on where you are, how bad this hurts. Major problem that the soldiers see, and I've talked to a lot of soldiers about this, the soldiers see this as a process that's going to produce a lot of refugees. Refugees who are trying to get out of where they are, like Mexico, and up to somewhere where there's still food, or at least jobs that you can buy food with, like the United States. Same coming out of North Africa and the Middle East into Europe, coming out of China up into Russia, coming down from the Philippines and Indonesia into Australia, things like that. And, of course, borders being closed against them. And the dirty little secret is you can only really close a border if you're willing to kill people who try to cross it. So, you know, the world gets a lot uglier. Failed states, governments that can't feed their own people, do not survive on the whole. What's the use of them if they can't even do that basic? That's job one. So failed states, which are pretty ugly things if you think about Somalia times 20, and in some cases wars. Wars between countries especially that have to share the same river system. Because when the going gets rough and there isn't enough rain to go around, the country that's upstream on the river is severely tempted to just hang on to the water and feed its own people and let the downstream country go hang. Downstream country has no recourse except war. So Nile River, Tigris and Euphrates, the Ganges, the Indus River, Mekong, all those rivers are places that wars could happen between the upstream and the downstream states when things get bad, because they probably will. And over the next 10 or 20 years, we can determine the outcome to the extent that it can either be very, very bad or only bad in terms of what the next generation's got to go through, but some of this stuff is going to happen. It's a bit too late to have no bad consequences.
It seems that it also is not necessarily going to follow a very particular pattern. For example, your book came out and then Russia was faced with huge droughts and wildfires, as was Australia, and these are very different parts of the world.
When you have a warming world, what you've got is a more energetic climate. Okay, there's more energy in the system, which means more extremes both of heat and of cold, which is why you get extreme winters as well as extreme summers nowadays. And it's also highly unpredictable as weather. I mean, you can say about climate or about the average global temperature, it's going up by 2 degrees in the next 30 years, let's say. But you can't say what the weather's going to be next week. And in fact, it's harder now to say what the weather will be next week than before, because extreme events in both directions are quite possible. And just to add a further degree of complication, you cannot actually assume that warming will take a gradual, predictable, incremental path. You know, we'll get 1/10 of a degree of warming every 2 years, and, you know, and then in 30 years we'll have a big problem. It can lurch. Which means that you could suddenly it's half a degree warmer all over the planet, which, although it doesn't sound like much, is actually a lot. It would hit crops very hard. I mean, one of the scientists, a guy called John Holdren, who's now the chief scientific advisor to Mr. Obama, said to me a couple of years ago, when you're talking about global temperature, you ought to think about it not like, is this a nice day or a slightly nicer day? You ought to think about it like the temperature of the human body, you know? And 98.6 is fine, and 100 isn't a lot more than 98.6, but you got a fever. It could get quite ugly all of a sudden. This is by no means guaranteed, but you can't discount the possibility, which is, by the way, I think, why the energy secretary, Stephen Chu, came out with this extraordinary idea in March of last year. He said, look, we know this stuff can lurch, and it's entirely possible that we would suddenly be faced worldwide with a sudden rise of a degree. And I'm talking a degree Celsius, so, you know, a degree and a half or more than 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit in average global temperature, and crops would start to fail all over the world, and there'd be mass famines, and bad things would happen to good people. So what could we do to get the warming down by a degree in a hurry? And he said, well, we've done the numbers. In fact, I know the guy who crunched the numbers. He's called Dennis Bushnell. He's the chief scientist at NASA's Langley facility. And if you just painted all the roads and roofs in the world white, you could lower average global temperature by 1 degree Celsius, because it would reflect enough sunlight to lower the temperature at the surface. We have a lot of roads. That's the sort of thing you want to have in your back pocket in case suddenly the system really surprised, paying attention to as well.
You mentioned early in the book that you thought that the collective efforts of individuals really would barely dent the problem.
Well, if you mean by our collective efforts, light bulbs and driving less, yeah, I'm afraid so. It's not that it's useless, it just isn't the solution. It's a way of winning time in order to get to the solution, but the solution is stop burning fossil fuels, and there's no other solution. Saving energy, as long as your energy is still being generated by fossil fuels, simply postpones the evil day when you put so much of this stuff in the atmosphere you get into runaway warming. And that evil day is generally defined as when we hit about 2 degrees of warming, average global temperature, because at that point we lose control, natural sources of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases kick in, the permafrost starts to melt and releases enormous amounts of this stuff. You can't turn the permafrost off. You can stop burning fossil fuels yourself, but if you get to the point where the permafrost starts emitting, you finish. You can't refreeze that. Same with the oceans. You warm the oceans and they go. Warmer water can contain less dissolved gas. They've got a lot of carbon dioxide in them, and if you make them warm, they're going to give some of it back to the atmosphere. It's like, you know, warm beer goes flat, so do warm oceans. Just conserving energies, provided that you're still basically providing your energy with fossil fuels, only postpones the evil day.
You've talked about some of the solutions that are being explored now. Worst case scenarios, we look at geoengineering types of things, although what we're doing now is already a form of geoengineering. Why don't you walk us through what seems to be feasible?
Your solution in the long run is stop burning fossil fuels. But the problem is that it's really hard to turn this civilization on a dime. It's like a supertanker. You can't do a tight turn at the corner. It takes a long time to turn the damn thing around. Are we going to run out of space? Are we going to hit that 2 degrees and unleash runaway warming before we actually get our emissions under control? And most of the people I know think the answer is yes. If you look at the way the politics goes, the United States doesn't even have any commitment to cut its emissions. Mr. Obama can say what he wants, but Congress won't pass it. Most countries have got a commitment to cut their commitments, but it's not nearly big enough to stop it short of the 2 degrees. And you look at those big international conferences and you do not feel inspired. Most of the scientists I've talked to, and actually most of the soldiers I've talked to, think that we are actually going to go past the point where you would normally get runaway warming. And here we have to do something slightly scientific, which is stop saying 2 degrees and talk about the actual amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that would give you 2 degrees. And that is 450 parts per million. We are now at 390 parts per million, so we aren't that far away. And 450 gives you 2 degrees. There is, by the way, signed up to over the last year, virtual consensus globally. Almost all the governments on the planet have committed to keeping us under 2 degrees higher average global temperature. The U.S. has accepted it, Russians, Chinese, everybody. If you're going to go through 450 parts per million, are you doomed to hit the 2 degrees that would normally give you and into runaway and good night nurse, you know? And the answer is not necessarily, because there are ways that you could actually hold the heat down even if the parts per million go past 450. Intervene artificially in the climate system to hold the heat down by reducing the amount of sunlight that reaches the planet's surface. And so you win yourself some more time to deal with your emissions and may take you another generation, but in the meantime, we don't get runaway warming, because if you don't go through 2 degrees, the permafrost doesn't melt, the oceans don't warm, these natural processes don't kick in and add to the warming, the ones that you can't turn off. So, you know, can we somehow divorce that 2 degree target, which we must not pass, from the 450 parts per million that we probably are going to pass through? The answer is geoengineering. Geoengineering is ways of uncoupling 2 degrees you mustn't cross from 450 parts per million you probably will cross, simply by holding the temperature down. And it's absolutely taboo for scientists to talk about geoengineering, even 2 or 3 years ago. You could lose all your status in the scientific community. Nobody did talk to you. People had nervous breakdowns from the flack they got when they opened their mouths on this issue, because the scientists reckon, and you can't really say that they were completely off base there, that if you tell the public there are ways to hold the heat down, the public, of course, being simple-minded darlings, will get the wrong end of the stick and go, oh, well, look, why don't we just hold the heat down and skip all this hard business of cutting our emissions? And the answer is no. To do that by geoengineering. Now the scientists are so scared that they're talking about it in public. The one that actually has got the most traction is an idea put out by a guy called Paul Crutzen. He got the Nobel Prize for his work on the ozone hole. And he said, look, we're going to go through 450 parts per million. We mustn't go through 2 degrees. How do we separate these things? I propose that we copy what big volcanoes do, because when a big volcano explodes, it will push a lot of gas up into the stratosphere. And the gas that the volcanoes tend to put out in huge quantities is sulfur dioxide, which, when it gets up there in the sunlight with, you know, little droplets of water around, combines with them to form tiny droplets of sulfuric acid, which will reflect sunlight. They do reflect enough sunlight after a big volcano blows to cut the amount of sunlight reaching the surface and lower the temperature. The last big volcano that blew was the Mount Pinatubo in the the Philippines 20 years ago. And for 2 years after that, we had an average global temperature 0.5 degrees Celsius, almost 1 degree Fahrenheit lower, thanks to the sulfuric acid in the stratosphere. There are still some questions. You wouldn't want to do this globally right now. You'd want to do small tests to make sure there's not a really ugly side effect you haven't thought of.
Wouldn't it be far more feasible and less expensive to actually build these wind turbines all over windy areas and set up the...
Of course it would. You're absolutely right. But do you really think it's going to happen? And if not, where's your fallback position?
Let's think about this for a moment just pragmatically. Because if the financial end of it, because that seems to be the argument against developing the infrastructures and the capacities. And so when we look at it and we go, geez, it just seems like these geoengineering ideas really pale in comparison to doing the very pragmatic things.
They'll happen eventually, but we're going to come up a day late and a dollar short, as human beings often do when faced with a big problem. We'll get there in the end, but the end will be a bit too late. Nobody plans to geoengineer until we're there. But, you know, if it is 2030 and we're at 450 parts per million and it is absolutely clear, though we've moved over a lot to renewables, that we're going to hit 500 parts per million before we get the thing stopped, what do you do? You know, and the answer is you geoengineer, because that's the last option you've got left. And if we do the miracle, I think it's a political miracle. It's not, I mean, you could do this. It's not even very hard or very expensive, but the politics is a killer. And if you get the politics right and you get all those renewables built and you're not burning fossil fuels anymore, nobody is going to want to geoengineer. But I look at the world as it is and I say to myself, this probably isn't going to happen in time. And this is the sort of answer I also get back from the scientists and the soldiers, all of whom want it to happen in time.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the climate wars, the scenarios we are facing, and our options as a humanity. Stay tuned. Look at a couple of things that you mentioned in this book. One is we look at the actual issue of climate change and the potential solutions and the very emotional responses that happen, especially from conservatives, for example, when you talk about regulation. And you cited this sociologist, Donald Brahman. Can you talk a little bit about his findings and how we might apply that?
I thought it was very interesting. He's a professor at George Washington University. What he did was he got a number of people who were self-described as conservatives, and when you sort of gave them a couple of questionnaires to answer, they clearly came up, you know, all nines for conservative. And he gave half of them a description of the problem of climate change and a proposed solution which involved a great deal of government intervention and regulation and even compulsion. And of course, they hated it. And furthermore, they didn't believe that climate change was a problem. This is not necessary. Government shouldn't be doing this. It's not a problem anyway. And if it is a problem, it's a natural problem not caused by us. This is nonsense. You give the other group of conservatives the same description of what the climate problem is, but now you offer them instead a set of solutions that involve unleashing private enterprise, investing in nuclear power, a full-on technological solution, which is largely in private hands. And they love it. And not only do they love it, but now they believe the climate science. It folds into how they think the world should work. He did this with liberals, too, and they were just as predictable.
What would be interesting then, and you mentioned also in your book that there are all of these enterprises exploring various types of alternatives, even ExxonMobil, which was the chief campaigner against the science, against climate science. And now you say they're pouring money into these new potential technologies like algae biofuel for airlines.
Oh, yeah. $600 million over 5 years. which is, you know, serious money even for ExxonMobil, more than $500 million, to develop a source of liquid fuel that you could use in cars, use in aircraft, so on, which is carbon neutral. When you burn it, sure, it puts carbon in the air, but it's only the carbon you took out of the air when you grew the plants that you take the fuel from. And the plant in question is actually pond scum. It's algae. The beauty of this compared to, you know, like growing corn, which is now taking up about a quarter of the good agricultural land in the United States, not to feed people or even to feed animals, but to provide us with ethanol, which is a crazy use of agricultural land. If you're doing it with algae, well, you don't need to use land, actually. I mean, agricultural land, you know, open ponds will do it, or you can grow the stuff in vats, or your only inputs are sunlight and carbon dioxide. The water you use can be wastewater or even salt water, so you're not using valuable agricultural water. And when you've grown this stuff, and it'll double its mass every 24 hours, you crush it. And out of the algae, depending on which strain you're using, you get somewhere between one-third and two-thirds of the mass is actually oil. And it's, you know, it's a vegetable oil, but if you can push it through an ordinary refinery and crack it, and you get gas off the top, diesel in the middle, bunker at the bottom, all of which will go through the existing distribution systems and will run existing engines. You don't have to change the whole system. So that's the kind of solution ExxonMobil is working on. A lot of other people are too. They finally realized that they're not oil companies, they're energy companies. And we're not going to give up our cars, but we do have to stop burning fossil fuel in them. So if you can get ahead of the pack and come up with a fuel that'll run these cars and is carbon neutral, you've just assured yourself two generations of market leadership.
So when you point out that the largest funder of the denial campaign, ExxonMobil, is actually trying to develop this new technology, and in the same breath, you also wrote about these other consortiums, for example, Desert Tech, which is designed a plan to power 15% of Europe through solar power in the desert. And then there are the efforts for geothermal and the wind. I mean, does that give you any hope that we aren't going to have to geoengineer and that we aren't going to have to build new nuclear power plants?
a little bit, but I mean, the task is immense and the timelines aren't good. I mean, we wasted the last decade. It'd be a lot more optimistic if we'd been working away at this over the last decade, but by and large, we weren't, although we understood by then what the problem was. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, I think we'll get away with this. Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, I don't.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about, for example, Desert Tech and these kinds of things that are being developed?
Well, this is a proposal which is actually, it's more than a proposal. There's now a contract signed, a whole consortium of really big European energy companies who are making a deal with the countries of North Africa, Algeria, Tunisia, so on. The idea is, you know, they've got 98% of their territory's desert. And it's the Sahara Desert, which is a fairly sunny place, as they say. So why don't you use that vast expanse of desert with very energetic sunshine, put in your solar arrays, you know, the sort of the little cells that collect the electricity from sunlight, and then there's not much market for it in Algeria, which doesn't have a huge power demand, but run a cable under the Mediterranean Sea and plug it in at the other end to the European energy grid. Now you're cooking, because there's a market. And why would the Algerians do this? Because they depend on selling oil now, but they know, A, that oil is going to become less and less popular, and if we get ahead of the problem, a lot of it will remain in the ground forever because we stop burning it, and even if not, they're going to run out of it. So here's an export that will go on giving into the generation after generation long-term future. Why wouldn't they do that? And in fact, they'd love to do it. So, I mean, there are this kind of these deals to be made, and people can make money at it. You know, the conservatives can rest easy. Private enterprise will do lots of this. In fact, most of it. But here's the thing. Why am I a pessimist about us getting all the way to there in time? It's this. We need a global deal in order to get this happening, because if any country starts investing in a big way in these technologies and spending the money and its trade rivals don't, then it's at a huge disadvantage. We are spending the money to fix the atmosphere for everybody, but nobody else is carrying their share of the load, and their products cost less than ours because we're spending that extra money. So you need a global deal where everybody puts their shoulder to the wheel, or nobody will. Why can't we make a global deal? Why do they keep meeting every December? Why can't they just say, okay, that's the problem, here's the solution, sign here? And the answer is that there's a real historical problem. And the historical problem is this: 80% of the greenhouse gases that are in the air now of human origin, the excess stuff that's causing the warming, was put there by a very small group of countries, of which the United States is one. You know, it's the old industrial countries, America, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Canada, Russia, Japan. We account for about 1/7 of the world's population. We put 80% of that stuff out there because we started putting it up there 2 centuries ago. We had our industrial revolution. We got rich because we were burning fossil fuels, and we've taken up almost all the space in the atmosphere that is available in terms of dumping extra carbon dioxide in there before you go past 450 parts per million and crash through the 2-degree barrier. So now all these other countries come along, China and India and Brazil and all the rest, who want to industrialize, who are now well on the way to doing it. But if they do it the way we did it, burning fossil fuels, we all go over the cliff together. So make a deal that somehow lets them go on growing their economies, but stops them from growing their emissions, because it's mainly them whose emissions are increasing now.
It would make sense for them to then develop the technology that would take us out of this mess.
Indeed, except they're still relatively poor countries. Right. So somebody's got to pay for that. And it probably isn't them. Actually, when you go to these big conferences, everybody knows what the deal is. I mean, it doesn't get signed, but everybody knows what it would look like if it were made. And it looks like this. The developed countries, because they are largely responsible for the fact that we're so near the edge now, take really big cuts up front. The numbers that were being kicked around 2 years ago in Copenhagen, 40% cuts in 10 years in our emissions, which is a big bite. Wouldn't be cheap, doable. You wouldn't have to mobilize like we did in the Second World War, but you definitely feel the pain. We take 40% cuts in 10 years. That sort of slows down the process and gives a little breathing space, and then we can do it a little bit less vigorously in the next decades, though we have to keep doing it. The developing countries don't take cuts. They cap their emissions where they are now. Don't expect them to take cuts. They're still poor. We're rich. We've been burning this stuff for 200 years. They've been burning it for 20. They still do per capita maybe a quarter of what we do per capita in terms of emissions. You mustn't expect them to take cuts. The most you can ask them is to cap their emissions where they are now. We'll take the cuts. And if they cap their emissions, that means they can't put any more fossil fuel sources of power in. They can't put any more coal-fired plants in. You know, their vehicles have to be fueled by something that isn't gasoline. Who pays the difference between the cheap and dirty coal-fired plant that China puts up every week now and the solar array, the wind farm, the nuclear plant, whatever it is that they put up instead once they sign that deal and agree not to increase their emissions? And the answer is we do. That's the deal. And it is fair, but it looks very lopsided. I mean, if any Western leader came home having signed that and said to the gathered nation, we've saved the planet, here's the deal, we're going to cut our emissions by 40%. The developing countries won't raise their emissions anymore. They're going to cap them. Oh, and we're going to be shipping $100 billion collectively a year to them so that they can go on growing their economies without growing their emissions. You wouldn't survive a week in office. That's why the deal doesn't get done. It will get done eventually. We do have an ability to learn, but it may be a bit late. And that's why on Thursdays, I'm a pessimist.
Well, Gwen Dyer, author of Climate Wars, The Fight for Survival as the World Overheats, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome, Maria.
When we come back, new global developments are changing the structure and holders of power. But what exactly does it mean to have power, and where does power come from? Stay tuned.
I will attack, and you don't want that.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm your host, Maria Armudian. New global developments are changing the structures and the holders of power. With new technology and greater interconnectedness, states are losing power and non-state actors are gaining power. But what exactly does it mean to have power, and where exactly does power come from? That's the subject explored by our next esteemed panel. We are joined by three experts on political power. Joseph Nye is the University Distinguished Service Professor at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He has published numerous books, including Soft Power, The Means to Success in World Politics, The Powers to Lead, and his latest, The Future of Power. Giulio Gallerati is professor of government in the College of Social Studies at Wesleyan University. He is the author of The Power Curse, Influence and Illusion in World Politics and Cosmopolitan Power in International Relations, a Synthesis of Realism, Neorealism, and Constructivism. Erica Chenoweth is professor of government at Wesleyan University and director of the Wesleyan Program on Terrorism and Insurgency Research. She's currently a visiting scholar at the Institute of International Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. She is co-author of Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict, and co-editor of Rethinking Violence, States and Non-State Actors in Conflict. I think what I'd like to do is start with the concept itself of political power. Of course, this has been long debated in political scientist circles. And an old definition emerging from a scholar, Laswell, said it was who gets what, when, and how. Of course, there have been plenty of others along the way. Professor Dahl and his contemporary said power is the ability to influence or cause change socially, politically, or economically. So why don't we start with what we mean by political power and where it comes from, who has it and who doesn't, and why. Joseph Nye, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I use a definition of power that's pretty close to what the dictionary says. It's the ability to get what you want by affecting others. And you can do this in three basic ways. You can do it with threats of coercion, so-called sticks. You can do it with payments, so-called carrots. Or you can do it by getting others to want what you want. And that's what I call soft power. And if you're able to attract others and get them to do what you want without having to coerce them or pay them, you can save a lot of carrots and sticks. So for me, power is that ability to get the outcomes you want, and those are the three ways you can do it.
Can you give us some examples of what you are talking about with the soft power in terms of politics?
Let me give you an example from Dwight Eisenhower, who was not only a president, but also a general before that. He said at one point, giving somebody a command is not very hard. Getting somebody to do something for you because they want to, he says, that's really hard. And so soft power is that ability to attract others, to get them to do something you want because they want to, not because you're coercing them or paying them.
And where do we see this in terms of the international playing field?
Well, we see it internationally when you come to situations where you can bomb another country or pay another country, or you can get another country to follow you because they're attracted. It's easiest to see in reverse situations. In 2003, President Bush wanted to send American troops into Iraq by having crossed Turkey, and he offered the Turkish government a very large aid package, essentially a bribe. The Turks turned it down because America had become so unpopular, it had lost so much of its soft power of attraction, that the Turkish parliament refused to go along with it. So the 4th Infantry Division, which was supposed to cross Turkey and enter Iraq from the north, had to go down through the canal and up through the Gulf and was late to the war. That's a case where the lack of soft power inhibited American hard power.
I think that's going to lead us later into the discussion about just causes and ethics and where those fall into the realm of soft power. But before we go into that, Giulio Gallerati, let's bring you in. Can you also talk about who has power and why?
Well, to pick up on what Joe said, and obviously he invented these concepts, and they're very important. And a lot of people are talking about them, not just among scholars, but also in the press and, of course, in politics. I wanted to kind of say that the way I conceptualize the difference between hard power is a way of coercing people to do what you want. Soft power is a way of cultivating compliance. That's the main difference. That's how I see it. I'd also like to add that the world has changed such that the utility of soft power has increased significantly, and the utility of hard power has decreased significantly, all because of some major changes in the international system over the past 100 years. First of all, because we have a security community among developed nations, and this idea of security community was introduced by Robert Jervis, who suggests that war between major powers is almost unthinkable. Now, in a situation where war and violence between major powers is unthinkable, heavy-handed methods that derive from hard power don't have much utility. People will find it much more difficult to use hard power to get what they want in that situation. Two other changes. One, the growth of economic interdependence. And where you have interdependent agents, it's very difficult, again, to use hard power, heavy-handed methods to get things, because you're both dependent on one another. You're mutually vulnerable. In a case like this, again, soft power is the way to go. And globalization has, of course, reinforced interdependence. Another change has been the rise of democracies, where you have national leaders and populations that fundamentally believe in the rule of law. And in an environment where people do believe in the rule of law, soft power gains much greater utility and much greater respect. Of course, we've also had a proliferation in the number of international organizations in the world and regimes, such that while the system is still anarchic, we've taken greater steps in moving toward a system which is governed much more by the rule of law. And in systems governed by the rule of law, hard power, which really has utility most in pure anarchy, really loses a lot of its utility. So I wanted to add that onto what Professor Nye has already said.
You bring a lot of really important points up in terms of the rule of law, and I think that is going to beg the question about some of the activities related to the United States itself and the issues of torture and the issues of United Nations resolutions and the contradictions there that I'd like to get into. But before we do that, Erica Chinwith, let's bring you in. You've actually looked at this relationship between state and non-state actors and related in part to democracy, and you've shown by your research the power of this soft power. Give us a thumbnail sketch of what you found.
Well, the way I'm thinking about power these days is a pretty simple definition, which is the ability to get people to obey. And the less it costs for a state to get people to obey, the more powerful they are. In other words, if a state doesn't have to invest that much in domestic security because people are more or less well-behaved and see the government as more or less legitimate, then that's a pretty powerful state. Whereas, counterintuitively, the states that have to spend a ton of money on internal security, like Egypt, for example, under Mubarak, they end up not being as powerful as they look on paper because they don't have the legitimacy that is required to be able to control the population, which is why Mubarak subsequently was ousted. And so my research basically looks at people as the source of power, that is, the population within the state, rather than sort of a top-down definition, because a state is only as powerful, or a leader is only as powerful, as their ability to convince not only the population to behave, but also the people that work for them. So the security forces, the economic elites, the civilian bureaucrats, as soon as those people stop obeying the authority of the leader, you can see that power crumbling. So I think that power really requires obedience in some sense. And what we're seeing around the world these days is sort of a corrosion of the sources of legitimacy that a lot of dictators have taken for granted.
I think you bring up a couple of really important points. One is legitimacy, and I think all three of you have talked about legitimacy a bit. Joseph Nye, let's bring you back in on this. You've talked about perceived legitimacy, and this being, I think you called it the third face of power. How does one become considered legitimate, perceived as legitimate, and how does that translate into power?
Well, legitimacy is a power reality. I mean, human beings don't act simply because they're coerced or because they're paid. We also act because of moral concerns or because we think something is right. And legitimacy is when others think that you have rightful authority. So the question of where that comes from is hotly debated. I mean, based back in the days of monarchies, it was the divine right of kings. What Max Weber pointed out was that it transfers also to the modern rational bureaucratic state. If a state is elected and has a well-ordered government, that's often seen as legitimate. But also legitimacy can be generated by charismatic leaders, somebody who has a particular attractive personality, which seems to give them a sense of right. So there are a variety of sources of legitimacy. I've just mentioned the famous Weberian trio. But in today's modern world, you can see that certain ideas, democracy and human rights and freedoms and so forth, are often sources of legitimacy, but they don't necessarily transfer across all cultures. What seems legitimate in the eyes of Americans may not look legitimate in the eyes of Saudi Arabians. So there are various sources of legitimacy, but the common denominator is that people are moved not just by carrots and sticks, but also by a feeling of what's right.
So that's the issue of ethics, morality, or a just cause.
Yeah, morality is a power reality. It's as simple as that.
So how does that fit in now with the idea of, say, and this actually fits with something else you've talked about, Joseph Nye, in your latest book, which is the issue of imperialism. You use the phrase imperial overstretch in that having compromised the United States' power potentially because of this moral issue. And last time you and I spoke, I asked you, isn't all imperialism imperial overstretch?
Well, imperial overstretch is the term was used by Paul Kennedy, the famous Yale historian, referred to the fact that as countries try to control areas beyond their borders, it becomes more and more expensive for them. And this indeed is what happened to the Soviet Union. The cost of military budget rose and rose so that eventually it became something like 22% of their gross domestic product. And so the more you try to control what's overseas, the more your expenses in the military sense go up as a percent of the total, and that's imperial overstretch. The United States doesn't fit that model in the following sense, that military budget's about 5% of our gross domestic product today, and that's has half of what it was during the Cold War. So rather than increasingly being overstretched budgetary terms over a long historical period like the Soviet Union was, we have not been. In the short run, right now of our current budgetary crisis, there is some tension between overseas operations like Afghanistan and the American military budget. But I don't really see the American situation as one of imperial overstretch in the sense that Kennedy defined the term.
Giulio Gallerati, would you agree?
I'm going to have to disagree with Joe on this, probably the first time I ever have. I do think that we're in a situation now where we have unrivaled hegemony. We have a global presence that's never been seen in history. Over 700 bases in 130 countries with roughly 4.5 million people, both civilian and military, carrying on operations. We're spending $400 million a day in Afghanistan and Iraq alone. Our power in nuclear weapons is unrivaled. And, of course, you know, we spend, you know, the famous fact that we spend, the military budget is a little less than the rest of the world combined. I do think that we are in a situation where we can no longer rule the world and deliver the American dream. And I think of this quote by Lao Tzu in the Tao Te Ching, who said, "He who commands others is powerful, but he who masters himself is mightier still." I think in this particular case, we have an interesting paradox of external power. external hegemony and internal weakness, I do believe we have some severe domestic problems. And even though Joe's quite right that if you look at it in terms of GNP and a comparative study, our defense spending is not exaggerated. However, when you consider the sensitive situation our domestic economy and society is in, we do see that there's a trade-off. And we are, at this point, a society in disrepair, I think, with 50 million people uninsured and with middle-class people being unable to afford the full price of health care insurance. And they're unable to afford tuitions at elite colleges. Our government deficit at this point is literally threatening the very institutions that undergird our social safety, net Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. This country, as rich as it is 21st in literacy. Our public education is deteriorating, and we have millions of people in prison and millions of people homeless. So I do think that even though as a percentage of GNP is small, some kind of redistribution of that money to these domestic problems would make great contributions to alleviating these problems. So I'm going to disagree a little bit with Joe on this.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about what power is, who has power, and how new developments are changing all of that. I want to also ask you, Giulio Gallerati, is there a relationship between all of this spending and presence in other countries and their own struggles for democracy and the soft power of the United States as you see it?
Well, we don't really have an empire in a classical definition in terms of having colonies. I think Chalmers Johnson is the one that pushed this phrase, an American empire. I think what we're really talking about is just the present. And clearly we have many, many bases, as I've said, and in some of these situations, there's really no conflict of interest. People are happy to have us there. The military are providing a number of public goods to the various communities. In fact, paradoxically, the military bases provide a lot of infrastructure and public goods. So in a sense, they're providing a lot of soft power themselves. But other occupations, for example, Afghanistan and Iraq, they're quite different in nature. So I think what you're seeing is, in terms of our military presence and what it means, there's definitely a mixed bag. It's not all evil, but it definitely generates points of controversy that cut against our legitimacy and influence in the world.
Erica Chen, with anything you'd like to add?
What occurred to me when I was listening to my colleagues is just that there is a group of scholars who argue that you can't really think of power, or at least American hegemony, in absolute terms. So a better question to ask sometimes is not just is American hegemony declining, but is it declining relative to other competitors or rival powers who are increasing in their power? And fortunately or unfortunately for the United States, many of its rivals at the moment are also suffering recession, or they have, as in China, significant development challenges that make it a long way off from being a real competitor. But nevertheless, there is a finite amount of power that any one country can accumulate, even if it is the most powerful country in the world at a given time. Basically, the history of international relations has been substitutions of empires, you know, one after the other. It was Britain, and then the U.S. and the USSR, and the U.S., and then who knows who's next. It rotates. Given where other great powers are today, that we don't really have to worry about any type of steep decline in the immediate future.
Joseph Nye, let's bring you back in. You've talked about how power is changing now in the 21st century, in part due to the economics, in part due to natural resources. You see a new rise of some states and a decline of others. How do you see this shaping up?
Well, I argue in the future of power that there are two big power shifts going on in this century. One is a shift from west to east, which you might call the recovery of Asia, so that Asia will recover during this century to being more than half the world's population and half the world's product, which is where it was before the Industrial Revolution in the West. That's a good process. That means more people are escaping poverty. It does, though, mean that there's a fear in some cases, for example, that China will become a considerable competitor and take over from the United States. I agree with Eric, as I said, that that's not imminent, and Asia has its own internal balance of power. The Japanese and Indians and Vietnamese don't want the Chinese to take over, and in that sense, they want an American presence. So I think there is a big power shift from west to east, but Asia is not one thing, and I think the Americans are not about to be overtaken by China. I do think, however, that the second power shift that I talk about, which is the shift of power away from all governments to non-governmental actors, is something that is more of concern. And that really is the effect of the enormous change that the information revolution has brought about, of reducing the barriers to entry, of playing a direct role in international politics. It's not that the governments are obsolete, but it just means the stage on which governments act is a lot more crowded, because players who were previously priced out of the action can now play in the game. And that we see most dramatically in the area of cyber power. You can be attacked now and don't know whether it's an attack by a hacker or by a criminal group or by another state. And so individuals or private actors are able to do things which previously were restricted primarily to governments. So these are the two big power shifts I see going on among states from west to east, and among all states from states to non-state actors.
When you talked about non-state actors in your book, when you wrote about them, one of the other emerging non-state actors that you talked about having an enormous amount of power now are these international corporations, because of the massive amounts of money that they move around. You said they're bigger than many states. Can you talk about what the effect of that is?
Yeah, the transnational corporation has been around for a long time, but its power has been increased by the information revolution, so that now you can find companies which will operate in dozens of countries with hundreds of thousand employees and able to shift the sources of the goods or sales quite quickly because of the Internet. And they can also shift vast amounts of money. I mean, you can get transactions, in some cases, can be bigger than the budgets of some countries. So there is enormous power in corporations. But it's one more thing worth noticing about corporations is that well-organized governments have three sources of power: their military capacity, their economic capacity, and their legitimacy. Corporations rarely have military capacity, and they may have legitimacy, but it's questionable in some cases. So they really are resting a lot of their power heavily on one leg of the stool, which is the economic leg.
Which is a pretty powerful leg.
Very much so. Very much so.
Well, Erica Chenoweth, since we're talking about non-state actors and since you study people and revolutionary movements, can you talk about the rise of these movements and their effect on the future of power?
Sure. My research and my newest book with Maria Steffen basically points to this argument that nonviolent mass resistance has increased both in its frequency and its effectiveness in the past 50 or so years, although it certainly existed and succeeded before that. What we argue is that when a movement is able to achieve a certain level of participation from within the society and across a number of different sectors of gender, religion, ideology, party, class, etc., they're often able to basically throw out leaders that they view as corrupt or incompetent. Even in very repressive or harsh dictatorships, they've often been able to expel foreign occupations, and they've often been able to cause secession or independence. And one of the most interesting findings is that these movements tend to be even more successful than violent insurgencies. And the reason this is interesting is because I think that it's been more or less conventional wisdom up until now that if you really want to get something done and you're a non-state actor and you don't have the monopoly on the use of force and you don't have the legitimacy of the state, you have to use violence to make that happen. And what we found actually is that these nonviolent resistance movements are more than twice as successful as their violent competitors. So ultimately what this says to me is that when large groups of people withdraw their obedience from the state and refuse to cooperate, they can affect major change in countries that have been stagnant for decades. And we're actually seeing this, I think, in what a lot of people are referring to as the Arab Spring. I think that it has such potential for changing the landscape of so many countries around the world that we're going to see its use more frequently, and we're going to see its success more frequently as well.
How would you contrast what is happening in Greece with what we saw with the Arab Spring?
Well, I think the Arab Spring has really created a demonstration effect, is what we would call it, which is basically that it's inspiring other movements around the world to also basically withdraw their obedience from the state. not everybody is going to withdraw their obedience from the state in the same way or toward the same goals. And what I see in Greece is basically a group of people that actually have a long history of rising up against their government. And it's interesting because a lot of the reports coming out from Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have indicated that there's some brutal repression going on. So it actually shares a lot in common with a lot of what's been going on in the Arab Spring.
Giulio Gallerati, you actually get the last word. So if you'd like to make concluding thoughts in this, feel free.
A couple of points I wanted to make is that the power game, the idea of power, national power, is very nebulous. It's a very uncertain game. Most people disagree about what it is, both scholars and national leaders. One thing that is troubling about power is that no one really knows how powerful they are, because power can only be identified and assessed when it's activated. We don't know how powerful we are before we're actually using it in a situation, whether it's a confrontation or a crisis. And it's hard to simulate a crisis or a confrontation. We can try, but we can only guess. So until that comes, we don't really know how powerful we are. Vietnam proved that we weren't very powerful, even though we thought we were. Another interesting characteristic about power and how leaders build power is that power is retrospective. Game, or the process of power accumulation, is retrospective. There's an old saying that we're always preparing to win the last war. And that's because people overlearn from history. Certain crises or events really dictate how we respond in terms of accumulating power in the future. A lot of experts on terrorism suggest that our approach to terrorism now is very backward-looking and not proactive. We're always trying to prevent that which happened before, but that terrorists are forward-looking, and they're always trying to find new ways of doing it. They're certainly not going to do it the way they did it before. So these are two troubling characteristics of power that suggest that it's hard for us to wrap our heads around it, and it's very, very hard for us to ensure that we're building up the kind of power that we desire.
We are out of time. There's so many more things that we could cover, perhaps in a future taping, including the three of you have all talked about democracy and that being one of the potential soft power, smart powers, is advancing human rights and democracy, and the United States' role in that, especially when the elections don't turn out how we like them. But for now, thank you so much for being with us. We've been speaking with Joseph Nye, who is a distinguished service professor at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. And his books include Soft Power, The Means to Success in the World Politics, The Powers to Lead, and The Future of Power. Giulio Gallerati is professor of government in the College of Social Studies at Wesleyan University. He's the author of The Power Curse, Influence and Illusion in World Politics, Cosmopolitan Power in International Relations, A Synthesis of Realism, Neoliberalism, and Constructivism. And Erica Chenoweth, professor of government at Wesleyan University, director of Wesleyan's Program on Terrorism and Insurgency Research, visiting scholar at the Institute of International Studies at University of California, Berkeley, and author of Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankine Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @Armudian.